16th and John, verse 33. In the world ye shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. In your imagination, go first of all the Middle Ages, where the philosophers and scientists of that day were striving to do two things. If life, we could imaginarily visit one of these people in his laboratory. It's what you would expect a laboratory to be in those ages. A rather clean room. Shelves on the wall and benches with various books or tomes, we might call them, and all the paraphernalia of a scientist. And we see our philosopher, he is in a sort of dressing gown. His beard is somewhat unkempt, so is his hair. But his eyes look very keen. And he's watching something which he's putting up on a brazier, some stuff in a test tube. What is he doing? Well, he's making these various experiments in order that he might, if he could, discover the elixir of life. That was one thing the philosophers of the day saw. It was something that would remove death, it would lengthen life, if only he could find it. The other thing he was trying to do sometimes was discover the philosopher's stone, as it was called. That was a substance which was able to transmute every other substance into gold. Now, these two desires of the ancient world, did people know it, were available. The definite lengthening of human existence, the definite enriching on human life. Had our philosopher in his little laboratory known it, he could have found how these things were obtained by consulting the manuscripts of the scriptures. They were known then, though not in the authorized version. But the documents containing this information, how to have life that never ended, and how to have life that was always enriched, that knowledge was there. Did they know it? And that's what Christ is saying. I have overcome the world. I have the power to make life unendable and to make it infinitely enriched. That's why I came into this world. I have overcome the world. This command, for it really seems to take the form of a command, was given to animals, and then it was fulfilled by Christ. If you go back to Genesis 1 and take the creation story, verse 27 and 28, it reads like this. So God created man in his own image. in the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. And God blessed them and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it. Now what could that have meant? Back in the days when Adam was created and sin had entered into the world. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and subdue it. So part of man's original commandment consisted on this grace, that the world in which he was placed was to be taken by him, used by him, treated by him, until all its faculties and powers and forces and abilities had been brought to his feet and used for his glory. But of course, it was never fulfilled. Sin came in, and the whole thing was ruined. Not only man himself, but the creatures in which he lived, with which he lived, the forces of the world, which should have been to his advantage, were all ruined by sin. So that now, when Christ comes into the world, he comes into an antagonistic, a ruined world. So that there is force in this statement, I have overcome. The commandment given to the first Adam is now fulfilled by the second. This was God's plan and purpose, which molded the ages. When he has made a commandment to man, he means it to be obeyed, and he doesn't intend that you should go on being disobeyed. But here is the one who subdued the world until he was king of lordship and life. You can see then what made the difference between Genesis 1 and John 1. You put them together at your leisure and compare them. And you don't read John 1 very far before you find that sin come in. And you have a very different picture from Genesis 1. That was what had happened. So that the world has become antagonistic. But everything in it, instead of being for man, or rather for God, was against him. We have sometimes some difficulty, I think, in realizing that everything since sin has been antagonistic to God. I doubt if you all believe that. Possibly you've never considered the point. To what extent sin and its influences have changed things. So that was great point in Christ appearing as the overcoming one. He has a reputation for this overcoming. Just notice a few scriptures which bring this out. In Revelation 3, we have the first one. In verse 21, to him that overcometh, I will grant to sit with me in my throne, even as I also overcame, and have sat down with my Father in his throne. We pass on to chapter 5, verse 5. And one of the elders said unto me, weep not. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, hath prevailed, same word, to open the book and to look the seven seals thereof. once more in the 17th chapter at the 14th verse. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is the Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. He has the reputation to be the overcomer. So well does it fit his name and character that he should say here to his disciples, I have overcome the world. But mark you, possibly among the last things he sent before he laid down his life on the tree. There doesn't seem to be much room for anything else after death. Here in John we have the prayer, in John 17 and in 18 we have the story of his being taken into God. You generally pay a great attention to the last words that people speak if you've been about Christmas. It sounds better, you know, than just saying world, but that's what it means. And so they speak of cosmical things and cosmological things and costs a good many others. It stands, first of all, for the created world with all its beauty and power and wonder. That was the cosmos, the world. It was the world in which he came, and it was the world in which he preached the gospel, and it was the world that he overcame as he overcame. Now we must look at some of the aspects of this, because his overcoming the world is a very complicated thing. Look at some of the things he must take and beat. First of all, the relationships of the world to man, which take the form of various temptations. Temptations that have come into it because it is a fallen world. Take here the fault of man. Well, we have Christ dealing with the matter of temptation in the wilderness. You remember the story. The tempter came to him, verse 3 in Matthew 4, if thou be the Son of God, command that these stones be made bread. Here he was in the wilderness between 40 days and 40 nights, and he had not eaten anything, and he was hungry. Hungry. Now, what could there be wrong in turning the stones into bread and so maintaining his life for the great aim that he got to fulfill? This seems a very reasonable suggestion. And he answered, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God. And then he takes him up to this holy city and sets him on the pinnacle of the temple. A high tower on the southeast corner of the temple in Kosher was known as the Pentagon, the pinnacle. And from that distance one could see down into the depths of the valley below. And now, says the enemy, cast yourself down. For God has said, thou shalt not dash thy foot against the stone. Look at all these gazing at you, perhaps the serpent meant. What a great thing it will be if before their eyes you cast yourself down from this and you don't get any harm or danger. How that will make disciples paid to. But again he says, thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. Then he takes him to a high mountain and shows him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them. And he says, all these things I will give thee if thou wilt fall down and worship me. For it seems to be, you see all these kingdoms and their power and riches and glory, but they are all under my control because of sin. I've got them. And you know how your life is going to end. It's going to end in suffering and death, our Lord. Fall down and worship me, and I'll give them all. And you'll have them without any tribulation and without any guilt. But he said, it is written, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him whom shalt thou serve. So these typical demon temptations and all that was under them and involved in them, he pushes a one side when he triumphs. Again, secondly, he must needs overcome the physical forces of the world. I think a good example of this is given us in Matthew 14:23. When he had sent the multitudes away, he went up into a mountain apart to pray. When he was comforted, he was there alone. But the ship was now in the midst of the sea, tossed with waves, for the wind was contrary. And in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went unto them, walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, it is a spirit. And they cried out for fear. This is a remarkable thing, you know. Back in Job 9:8, we have this, which alone spreadeth out the heavens and treadeth upon the waves of the sea. Suppose I know that's the only place that speaks of God treading on the waves of the sea. And here you see him doing. And the word doesn't mean just that he ran down one wave and up the next. It means he strided the waves, leaped from one crest to the other in glorious majestic dignity. This was Jesus. I have overcome the world. It's no use talking about hydrodynamics and other dynamics, aerodynamics, or all the rest of them. Here is the one who has them that is found. And did we but know it, we should see that this was a very simple thing to do when Christ overcame the world. But certainly, it's also true of his creatures. In the first chapter of Mark, at verse 13, we have a hint of this. Immediately the Spirit driveth him into the wilderness, and he was there in the wilderness 40 days, tempted of Satan, and was with the wild beast. Thank you. He was with the wild beast. There wouldn't be any wild beast, you know, if you hadn't been sin. It's even affecting the dispositions of animals. I don't know how, but it's so. But this man is the true. And he doesn't mind going into the wilderness for the coming of the wild beast. I visualize that he stroked them and coaxed them. They were all friends when he was there because he has overcome the world. But nobody else would seek their company and presence. But it's also true if we apply this in the fourth place to his dealing with evil men. We looked at this place not long since. John 2, verses 13-18. This was the case of where he cleansed the temple. You remember how he made a scourge of small cords that he drove out the money changers and turned out the oxen and the sheep and the dove. Nobody says anything. They come to him up and say, who gave you charge to do this? I can't even imagine what would have happened if somebody had gone into some market that you know and on market day and started turning over all the sorts. You don't imagine he'd get away with it for very long. But nobody says anything here. Nobody raises a little finger to say anything. I account the world. And these men can do nothing. But it's even more extraordinary when you notice that he also is Lord of friendly people. And this is a big case. In Matthew 14:22, and when he has sent the multitudes away, he went up into a mountain to pray. And just before it said, straightway Jesus constrained his disciples to get into a ship and to go before him unto the other side while he sent the multitudes away. Have you ever asked yourself how he did that? We can understand that he should gather people as he did, gather great companies to him. But this was the reverse thing. This was sending people away who wanted to stay there. How did he do it? I think if you ask an experienced police officer who's used to dealing with crowds, it would tell you it's not an easy thing to disperse people. Then how did he do it? And it wasn't an ordinary crowd either, because John 6:15 says that when Jesus saw they were coming to make him a king by force, he went up to the mountain to pray. How did he escape death? Being taken and impressed as a king. There was something there the disciple couldn't manage, so he sent them kindly away on a boat. Go to the sea. Get out of it. I'll deal with the crowd. And you've seen the Lord of heaven and earth dispersing the people. It has to remain a mystery to us what happened. But there it is. Maybe we shall know it one day. But we also see him exerting his lordship over demons. I think of a passage in Luke 8:28. It's the case of the man who met him from the tomb. You remember about the story. This is part of it. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell down before him, and with a loud voice said, what have I to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of God most high? I beseech thee, for torment me not. For he had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man, for oft times he had called. he had been caught and bound in chains and fetters, but he breaks the band and was driven by the devil into the wilderness. And Jesus asked him, saying, "What is thy name?" And he said, "Legion," because many devils were entered into him. And then they make the command that if he turns them out, they may go into the herd of swine. It's an amazing thing. This man was possessed not just with a devil, but with Satan. It's obvious. We can't think of demon as occupying space. We know nothing about space here. They can all crowd into one hand. Although that might be distributed among many people. But he has command over them all. And they know it. Art thou come hither to destroy us before the time? When he says the word, out they go. He is Lord even over demons. And in the seventh and eighth places, I must remind you, the principle of all these things, Jesus overcomes the world by overcoming its root cause of iniquity, sin, and overcoming its main consequence, death. These were the poor things the philosopher was seeking to find. On the cross, he got his final blow of the enemy's sin, which had, through the past ages, defied God. For those things God had passed over, but now the time had come for their defeat. And so it is said that he made to meet on him the iniquity of us all. There's a deeper meaning in those words. It means that he carried sin up to the tree. It wasn't just on the cross that the load of sin was laid upon him, but he bore it from the beginning of his ministry, and he carried it up to the cross, and there he nailed it up forever. I have overcome the world. With sin gone, there's nothing else can trouble you. Because the ending of sin means the ending of death. Not that this presence of sin is gone, of course, any more than the presence of death is gone. But the fact is, sin is no longer any power when Christ has triumphed. And death is no longer any power when Christ has triumphed. The early Christians knew death. Oh, death, where is thy sting? Oh, grave, where is thy victory? The sting of death is sin, and the strength of sin is the law. But thanks be to God, which giveth us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. You see, if it's sin, if it's death, Christ has won the victory. So that even now, as we face these things, they are a beaten thing. As we face death, it's a beaten enemy, though enemy is from the last God. He is the triumpher. I have overcome the world. What more could he say than to make this trenchant statement just before he left these disciples? And when they really understood it and the power of his spirit came upon them, then you see them not like frightened sheep but like enraged lions going out through the eastern world, so that people say they have turned the world upside down. Of course, he had overcome the world. These were overcomers, speaking the overcoming message, and the only message that can overcome. Farewell for victory over the world and sin. We must be linked with Christ by faith. The scriptures make that clear. This is the victory that overcomes the world. So John 5, 4, I think it is. This is victory that overcometh the world, even our faith. For faith is the link that binds us on to the other's triumph, and one has triumphed. We must triumph.